Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, this is the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today, money talks in the Champions League. Have we been sleepwalking towards European Super League all along? Manchester City stand 12 games away from footballing history. How possible is the quadruple? UEFA disappoint once again in the fight against racism in the game. And what are the most cynical, crazy, strangest red cards you've ever seen? All that and more on the next hour of the game. To help me through it all, Gregor Robertson, Tom Roddy, and Jonathan Northcroft. How are you doing, guys?
Very well, you?
I'm very well. Nice to hear from you. Been enjoying the Champions League football, obviously. We've had some cracking games. The competition was really, I think, back to its best in terms of drama and excitement this year as well. So it was good to see. And of course, two legs, which is what you want. That's been a while as well. The semi-final lineup complete. The Champions League will have two English sides in the final four, flying the flag. Chelsea coming past Porto 3-1 on aggregate, and Manchester City, who beat Borussia Dortmund 4-3 on aggregate. Of course, Liverpool were knocked out. They lost 3-1 to Real Madrid overall. And Paris Saint-Germain knocked out the holders on away goals in the shape of Bayern Munich after a 3-all aggregate draw. So it means the semi-finals to be played on the 27th and 28th of April. See Real Madrid host Chelsea in the first leg, and Manchester City visit Paris Saint-Germain. Before we get to the ins and outs of the football itself, the semi-final lineup, I think, has left some football fans feeling a little bit empty. The old money of the likes of Juventus, Bayern Munich, Manchester United, AC Milan, even Barcelona and Liverpool have, to an extent, faltered. And the nouveau riche, let's call them that, have excelled this year. Jonathan, with less strict financial controls on the way, do you think this is the new face of the Champions League? These clubs being there every year?
I certainly think that Manchester City are here to stay. That something very lasting has been built there. And, you know, maybe 10 years ago, we'd have asked the same question about Chelsea. And now we're used to seeing Chelsea up there. It's not just about having money. It's about using money wisely, using it well, investing it well. And these are clubs that have got untold riches, but have actually used it cleverly to invest in something. And yeah, I do think we will, we've talked about European Super Leagues and how the Champions League is kind of naturally evolving in that direction, with the execs of certain clubs trying to push UEFA even further to sort of rig things that way. I think the future is going to be a familiar bunch of clubs, and there's going to be a point where we stop talking about Manchester City as something new and talk about them as the establishment. You know, they will be the establishment one day, because I've got no doubt they're not going to go away. The one I always look at PSG, and maybe it's just ignorance looking at it from outside and not being part of the French media and understanding the club well enough. Something seems to me that it's built more on sand and more on star players and something transitory. But that might, as I say, that might be my lack of understanding. I'm quite willing to accept that. But when I look at Manchester City, I see investment in the whole club that's kind of grindingly efficient and grindingly good use of money. That means that they're here for a long time. We'll see, man. Manchester City, that was only the second Champions League semi-final. There'll be a lot more.
Tom, state-backed clubs is something that we've seen in football more and more. And it might be eventually, I think, the thing that that works against the Champions League in many ways, in that the gap is becoming so big that for many, domestic football is going to be more than just the bread and butter. It's going to be the only thing really worth watching. And look, for the purists, for people who are traditionalists, you know, seeing that level of investment into a football club maybe takes something out of the joy of sport as well.
Perhaps, yeah. But I mean, watching that Bayern Munich PSG, the two legs over the last week or so, I wasn't really thinking in that way. I didn't really think about, you know, I wasn't thinking about how the money got there. I wasn't thinking how it was invested or why it was invested, any of that. I was thinking, wow, this is a great game and what a privilege it is to watch it and how hard it was to try and watch the Chelsea-Porto game at the same time. I think one point on that, with the idea of this, the European Super League, I saw a lot of comments saying, you know, how much I'd love to watch this game every week. I wouldn't, you know, I'd love, there's the idea of it, but it's like having Christmas every week. It wouldn't be so special having it once a year, having it once every 2 years, a game like that. It makes it more special. It makes you appreciate it that much, that touch more. And it's funny as well, looking at the final four and thinking that Real Madrid, just going back to your previous question, Hugh, thinking Real Madrid are quite possibly the side that are seen as probably maybe the weak link, thinking of the past decade of Champions League football. And there's also, you know, if RB Leipzig were there, these four teams could be the most despised kind of in European football at the moment for that very sort of reason. I just enjoyed it, really. And I think also it's probably a personal point of view, but with Pochettino going to PSG, there was a willingness to kind of see them succeed.
The other thing about, you know, this, the idea of, do we want to see these games more often, was that the away goals rule was part of what made it so thrilling. I know some people still have, you know, people have different opinions about this, but at no point were you more than one goal away from these, from that, particularly that PSG Bayern game, from it swinging completely into the other team's favour. So that was part of what made it so entertaining, the jeopardy that was there all along. There were very fine lines have decided these games. I know you're talking about the rise of PSG and Man City and, you know, state-backed football clubs. And yes, they have progressed, but it was on very, very fine margins. And, you know, PSG have still not won it. They're looking like they're in with a shout this year, but it's hard to call. And it's the same with City. City, until they were gifted a penalty, they were probing, but they weren't finding a way through. So it was still very fine lines deciding all these games, really, apart from Chelsea-Porto.
It's not a new thing as well. Real Madrid are pretty much the original state-backed football club, you know, not in the same way in terms of their ownership group, but they've always been helped out, shall we say, by the Spanish government et al. Okay, let's talk about the football then. I can come back to this discussion, I think, later on in the competition, particularly if Manchester City win it. Let's talk about the games, Gregor. Liverpool, just quickly on them, before we talk about the sides that went through, they had chances. They had the chances to beat Real Madrid last night. They're out, of course, and after that first leg, it was almost inevitable, and barring something particularly special. 7 games left in their season now, all Premier League matches. Getting knocked out the Champions League, is that almost a bit of a weight off their shoulders that they can go into their final stretch, knowing if they do play well and form has been coming back, Champions League football will come back to the club for next season?
They might come to feel that way, but at the same time, there's, you know, we're in the final stretch of the season and they have nothing else to play, no silverware to play for, which in a club in the health of Liverpool in recent seasons is fairly chastening, really. Yeah, they had so many chances last night, particularly obviously Salah's right at the start. That could have transformed the way the game unfurled from that point. But I still never, you know, there was bursts of the kind of energy and the pressing that we've come to know of from Liverpool, but it still wasn't really the same Liverpool way, you know, not peak Liverpool. And Real Madrid ultimately were in control for large swathes of the game. So yes, they'll look forward now, Liverpool, and it's not an easy run, and you've got Leeds and then Manchester United coming up soon. And then it eases off a little bit. We've got West Brom, Burnley and Palace in the last three games. So, you know, I think these next few weeks are actually going to be the more likely to be the ones that decide Liverpool's fate in terms of the Champions League. And as I said on Monday, just looking at it, it's very hard to call, but I just feel that probably after all these, you know, these clubs that have had brilliant seasons, Leicester and West Ham, probably just like it does in the Champions League, the money will tell in the end, and we'll see the same four clubs we're used to seeing in the top four.
I'm looking forward to the run-in. It should be very, very good to watch. I wonder what part Liverpool will play in it, because that defence, you know, it's been better, but will it be at the level? You know, some of those final few games still to me look difficult because they haven't sorted out how they want to play with those weaknesses at the back. Got a clean sheet against Real Madrid at home, credit to them, but I think if they'd have come out, tried to score more, been a little bit more expansive, it would have cost them at the other end as well. Real Madrid didn't really have to ever put their foot down in terms of trying to win another goal. Let's talk about Manchester City next. Liverpool are out. Let's talk about the teams that went through. They've got 12 games left in their season to win a quadruple. They've got Spurs in the EFL Cup final coming up, Chelsea in the FA Cup semi-final this weekend. Of course, we've mentioned PSG in the Champions League semis, and the Premier League all but wrapped up already. Jonathan, this would be a tremendous effort, despite the money that's been spent. Are they good enough, Manchester City, at this point on form in the season? Do you look at them and think they're going to win everything?
Oh, they're good enough. Look, they can do it. Do I think they will do it? I still have two things give me a reason for doubt. I suppose one is just that I know that Guardiola did it with Barcelona. I think he won 6 trophies in a year, and Bayern Munich did it just this last year, actually. They, until they got knocked out last night, they held 6 trophies. So of course it can be done, but it hasn't been done in English football because it's, I guess, just it's been harder to win the English domestic competitions at the same time as a successful Champions League campaign. So history tells you it's still tricky. And you remember how extraordinary the circumstances of Manchester United getting that treble were, you know, 99. That's what it takes. But the team, they're capable of it. You know, they play such sort of unchanging, dominant football. It doesn't matter who the opponents are. Guardiola's got those patterns of play. He's got the sort of almost automated way of his players playing, where they know the passing patterns, they know each other's movement. It's so well coached and drilled that it's almost less about the individual challenges than about pulling the whole thing off. That there is a football reason for me doubting, having a question mark in my mind, and it's just no matter despite how good they were against Dortmund last night, at times they did struggle to score goals. As Gregor said, they were gifted a penalty. And it took a superb strike by Foden to give them the second goal, which came from a set piece, actually. And it made me think about the game against Leicester I saw recently at the King Power, where City were out of this world. They were absolutely dominant. Leicester played okay, and they just couldn't get close to them. But it was only 2-0, and Leicester had opportunities to score on the break. Because City lacked that striker, because they're not quite turning dominance into the fours and the 5-0s in the way that we've seen previous Guardiola teams do. So in football terms, if they do get found out, it may be in a game like Saturday's that I'm going to, the Chelsea City FA Cup game. It may be a Champions League semi-final, a tight game where that lack, decided by a single goal, where that lack of cutting edge just hurts them.
Tom, do you think we learned more about City's weaknesses during their tie against Borussia Dortmund than we did about their strengths? You know, a long floated ball, you know, over the top, you know, causing confusion. I think Leeds United showed in many ways last weekend as well, you know, this idea that sort of City are on you, they press you, that they've got the ball, but as soon as you win it, you smash it long, and you've got a striker up there who's putting themselves about, then you might get some joy. And it seems like a really uncomplicated way to get success against a team that's as good as Manchester City.
Yeah, quite possibly. Not everyone's got a striker like Erling Haaland, though, is the only thing. But I think that it's, you know, this I don't think it is 12 games for them to win the quadruple. I think it's probably only six, isn't it, really? Because the league title is wrapped up. You've got the two semi-finals of the Champions League and the final, the semi-final this weekend and the final of the FA Cup. So I think they're really six games away from winning the quadruple, which is incredible. It really is incredible. What happens if they only win the Premier League now? Because that's the thing with football as well, isn't it? You get to the business end, you're so close to it, and then it all falls apart. Does just winning the Premier League become a bit of a deflated end to the season? I think they have enough to do it. I completely agree with Johnny. I think they have enough to do it. Definitely. Whether they will, I'm not so sure. I think also with the Champions League, the semi-final, I think they will have gone into that game believing that they are the favourites, and their biggest test will be the semi-final when they come up against the likes of Neymar and Mbappe and a team who have been a contender for quite a few years. I think that's when they actually maybe question themselves, when there's that possibility to question themselves, is when we'll actually see how they actually handle that.
My concern about them is the amount of changes that Pep Guardiola continues to make and that level of rotation. Five changes, I think it was, then seven changes in the last couple of games going into that that second match against Borussia Dortmund. And he's been doing it for quite a while now, in fact, since it seemed like they were going to be healthy winners in the Premier League. You know, he's regularly made changes, and it's to the point that I think it's disrupted their rhythm. They were metronomic for a period of time. Ilkay Gundogan, of course, was looking like he was going to be the player of the season. That didn't fizzle out. Kevin De Bruyne just came back from injury. And Pep Guardiola decided to shift the Premier League's informed player back to where he was playing before and not scoring all those goals and getting all of those assists. You've got to try and integrate De Bruyne. I'm not going to criticise him for that. But Gabriel Jesus came back from injury at that time. Sergio Aguero came back from injury at that time. He tried to play Aguero. That doesn't seem like it's going to work. He's in and out, Jesus. Sterling is currently in and out. Mahrez seems to get the nod in the bigger games, but then goes out of the team as well. Foden comes in and out. Look, clearly exceptional players there, but if you're going to go in these next six games, you have to peak at the right time. All sports, not just football. And that means you've got to know what your best team is, and they've got to be at the races. And if anything is going to stop them this season, it's going to be Pep changing that team. I'm prepared to stick my neck out on that one.
But he clearly say that he needs to. I mean, the number of games they've got, and you've got to utilise this.
He needs to, but I think there is a difference between making three changes a game and making seven changes a game.
Perhaps, but as Tom said, the league's wrapped up, so that's the game where he's gonna rest players, and they've won the league. I can't see Tottenham. I'd be very surprised personally to see this current Tottenham team give them many issues in the League Cup. But Chelsea are in good shape, and they're playing with a lot of kind of control. That could go either way, that game, definitely. And PSG, as you've said, City's biggest weakness to Guardiola's teams, essentially, has been a team who can play well on the counter. And we've just seen PSG do that to Bayern Munich and look absolutely ridiculously threatening all the time. So it'll be interesting to see how Pep even sets up in that game in the knowledge of that, you know, safe in the knowledge. Are we still just going to impose our game and try and dominate play and trust our centre-backs to be able to deal with them? Or are we going to play slightly differently? That's going to be very interesting to see. So I still think it would be remarkable if they do it, because football just always throws up something. It could be a bit of bad luck. It could be a nonsense VAR decision like we saw them getting the good fortune of against Dortmund. It's not a VAR decision, actually. It was a refereeing decision, but VAR couldn't step in. Bellingham's goal I'm talking about. You know, it could be something like that. Football always throws something up, and I think for them to do it in all four competitions would be truly remarkable.
If they do it, Gregor, have they completed football? Can we pack it all up, stick it in the attic? It's done.
I know that all those conversations will come out. If you see like another 7-0 victory in a cup final or something, then yes, I think that will be the narrative, undoubtedly. But would we pack up football? No, I think we'd really have to. You would have to applaud them for, despite all of the you know, the knowledge about their funding and the amount of money they've spent on players and how much their squad costs and everything. It's still a thrilling team to watch, and Pep Guardiola is a genius, and it would be an extraordinary achievement.
I don't think you pack up football, because history tells us, we, you know, with the Liverpool team of last year, with the City team of the year before that, we got to the end of the Premier League season and said about both those teams that they could dominate for a decade, and they didn't at all. It fell off, and I think the same would happen in this situation. I don't think City would dominate for years to come. I think they'll be up there. I'm not saying that. I think they'll be that established team, but they're not going. I don't think they do it. They carry on doing it in the same way for years to come. So it's definitely not a case of packing up and going home.
I would fear for football if the traditional clubs were making the most of their resources and City were still winning. But that's not the case at the moment. You know, we're in an era where a number of the traditional clubs, shall we call them, are using the money badly, making bad decisions in terms of coaches or you know, infrastructure at clubs, giving silly contracts to people. I've got reserve that we could have a whole long talk about state football and human rights in Abu Dhabi. But to park that, as I said earlier, I see in City, regardless of where the money comes from, a club that has made excellent decisions, appointed maybe the best coach in football, incredibly, you know, thought out recruitment. If you look at how close in age profile, in playing profile, a lot of the signings are over a number of years, how few of them actually go wrong. The investment in youth and facilities. If Manchester United or Real Madrid or Juventus or whoever you want to say, Arsenal, if they were using their money as wisely as City used theirs and City were still winning, then okay, worry about football. But I think there's a lot of improvement for those traditional clubs to make. And that's they should be looking at themselves in terms of catching up instead of crying about how much money City have got.
There was a tweet, a momentary tweet, although it did manage to rack up thousands and thousands of likes and shares from the Manchester City player Phil Foden after the game. It was very quickly deleted. It must have come from his social media team. He said, at Kylian Mbappe, are you ready? Looking ahead to that semi-final, and a picture of him scoring his goal last night. And Gary Neville was on Twitter afterwards, the former Manchester United defender, of course, and he made some comments about players. He basically says, I mentioned on here a few weeks ago, players having their accounts run by social media companies. Lads, run your own accounts. Your independent thought and authenticity is at stake. It's your voice, not anyone else's. Go and attack the hell out of it. Good morning, by the way. Jonathan, has he got a point in terms of players' personality and perception?
He does. I remember Troy Deeney saying this to me 3 or 4 years ago, and he was laughing at just all those sort of bland messages that you get from players, you know.
We go again.
Yeah, we go again. The fans were great tonight, you know, and the team's just been dreadful. They've been beaten 5-1, but it's all, you know, it's all that sort of nonsense. And he was just like, you know, how can lads look at themselves in the mirror and have that kind of bland nonsense coming out under their names? And that's Neville's point. It's your personality, it's your image, it's your chance to put yourself forward. I mean, look, players do need help. Marcus Rashford's a case where his social media has been unbelievably good as part of the campaigning that he's done. And he has had help from a very sort of, you know, top of the range communications agency to help him with that. But you'd like to think that players will understand that they do need to vet everything, or they need it to reflect them. I mean, I think of Gareth Bale this year when Mourinho called him out, didn't he? When he tweeted good training session today, and Jose went mad in his press conference. I mean, he had an awful training session. What's he talking about? You know, and it was just an automated message that his team had put out. Social media is there for people to be themselves, and it's, you know, maybe not everyone's as Gary Neville's famous for his attention to detail, and every, you know, gets up at 5 in the morning and is on everything. Maybe not everybody's as keen as Gary Neville to be on it, but there are lessons to be learned for players.
That's the thing, yeah. I think there are some people who perhaps, you know, their natural instinct is not to be doing, to maybe sending out tweets after a game, but they'll have advisors who say, look, you need to have a presence on social media because you get more followers, you'll make more money from this, that, and the other. So, you know, there's a reason why they have these people in these teams. I look at someone like Declan Rice, who clearly loves being on social media, and you see his personality shining through on it. But that's just who Declan Rice is. Phil Foden perhaps isn't like that. So you can see why these players have people doing it for them nowadays, because their natural inclination is not to put cringeworthy things on social media after a game, or to take the mickey out of teammates on social media, things like that. So I can see why it happens, but I don't know. It's still slightly... it's not a great look when you have to kind of rebuke your own advisors for a tweet that's supposed to be on your personal account.
Yeah, I think one of the things that maybe as well think footballers, if they are out there with their personalities after a game on social media, we know the abuse that they already get. And they can't win. You know, there's always going to be someone who says, what are you so happy about? You know, you played rubbish even though the team won 1-0, or... you know, vice versa. If the team loses, you put a message out and everyone slams you. You know, there is a part of, we want players to have personalities. We want them to be on social media. And we've spoken about it before, so there's no reason to go into it once again, but they aren't protected from the negative things. And so for some of them, I think it's a space that they don't want to be in, and they'll happily pay a company to put some stuff out for them so they don't have to see some of the interactions that are on there. Tom, what do you think about all of it?
I think that I agree in that it is a space and an opportunity to be a personality, to be a character, and we've seen it with quite a lot of players. As Gregor said, probably the name that springs to mind is Declan Rice. But at the same time, the problem is these players are worth so much to more people than just individually themselves. They are now brands and companies, and that is the voice for them. That is where the message comes from. And so it has to be people. This makes this sort of I don't like this, but it has to be carefully, these people believe it has to be carefully orchestrated, what is said, how it comes out, and how it is projected. And the problem is we see occasionally where there's miscommunication even there. I mean, do you remember a couple of weeks ago, Joe Hart issuing an apology for his social media team posting the wrong result when Tottenham had been beaten 3-0. I mean, like you said, Hugh, we've spoken about this before, but I just see social media as something where players, if they don't want to do it, and you do hear a lot of people talk about players being impacted so much by the negative comments on social media, if they don't want to do it, then don't do it. It's not worth the hassle.
And as we talk as well, another social media story growing. Tottenham Hotspur have announced Dulux Paint as their new official paint supplier. And whoever the admin is for Dulux has not got the memo, because someone said to them, we can store the tins of paint in the trophy room as we don't seem to put anything else in there. They've replied, you know this, with a picture of an empty trophy cabinet. To another tweet as well, someone says, why don't we paint their dusty trophy cabinet? They've replied, don't be silly, surfaces need to be dust-free before painting as well. And someone put a picture of their traditional mascot, their fluffy dog, Dulux. Someone said, does the dog play centre-back? And the admin has replied, our dog might do a better job, to that person as well. So clearly, the Dulux admin has not got the memo. Or Gunnosaurus is working in his new job after being furloughed by Arsenal as the admin for Dulux Paint. One of those two things. I wonder if they'll be getting a good review from the Tottenham Hotspur admin a little bit later on. You can give us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcast from. Also, make sure you're subscribed. You can get a digital subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times right now across all of your devices. If you sign up today, you'll get 1 month free. Just go online, search thetimes.co.uk/the game to get started.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
Chelsea and their manager Thomas Tuchel can look forward to a mouth-watering tie against Real Madrid in the Champions League semi-finals. It's the first time in 7 years that Chelsea have reached the Final Four. They came past Porto 2-1 on aggregate. Tuchel says he wants his side to stay brave and adventurous. Now, that is not exactly how you describe their football right now, is it, Tom?
Brave and adventurous. No, not quite. I mean, the most sort of adventurous we've seen may appear to have been Saturday against Crystal Palace, but even then, the only reason that they really scored the four goals in that game was because Palace were so poor. Truth be told, that was the reason. But I think they've missed. I still have enjoyed watching them play. I think it's interesting to watch, and they're, Gregor touched on it earlier, hit the nail on the head really, that they control games. You feel that Thomas Tuchel, he talks about before games how they're going to play out, and they do more often than not. Maybe not West Bromwich Albion, but most of them tend to as well. I think the key for Chelsea is the striker position, because everywhere else they have strength in depth and real sort of the top of the pile in terms of quality. But the striker position is one where I think Tuchel will already be looking towards the summer and bringing in a replacement. He clearly isn't taken by Tammy Abraham. He has tried to play Kai Havertz as this false nine, which sometimes seems to be working. But he made the point the other day that he's not going to ever be the Diego Costa. He's not going to be a fighter. And it's far too early to kind of cast judgment on how Kai Havertz is going to be, what kind of a player Kai Havertz is going to be at Chelsea and how he's going to be remembered. He's clearly got the talent, but whether he kind of has the drive to actually make it there will probably be seen over the next year, this next season coming. And depending on if they do bring in a striker in the summer, then where does he fit into that team? I'm not so sure. And then you've got Timo Werner, who probably works best off the left. And I think he will come good. I think next year we'll see him scoring lots and lots of goals the way we expected to this year once he settled in. But I think that's what they're missing, is a striker.
Gregor, what do you think about Chelsea's chances in the Champions League? Some very good sides left. And the way that they play football as well, because there is a part of me that believes you need a little bit more firepower, as Tom's pointed out, to win a competition like this.
Yeah, but I come back to, if you're getting clean sheets in so many of your games, then you've always got a chance. And clearly they're coming up against a superior opponent. It's going to be interesting because this Real Madrid are kind of, and as I said earlier, they're also against Liverpool. They exuded control, and the experience kind of shown through as well from them, despite all the churning. There's been, well, I think there's three of their back four probably wouldn't be in the first choice back four. They still looked very well coached and organised and solid. And yes, Liverpool created some chances, but there was always like a leg out stuck out in front of them. There was always a block made. There was always someone there. Always someone within a yard or two ready to kind of snuff it out. And so these are, two teams who are going to want to try and kind of, as I say, to say they're risk averse is not true. It's just that they want to dominate the ball and kind of construct attacks. So I think it could be quite a cagey affair, actually. But Real Madrid's, particularly in the midfield, again, they're just a joy to watch. And, Kroos on the ball and Modric, how crafty he is and how good he is in little tight spaces, and Casemiro's control of the game essentially in that second leg against Liverpool was outstanding. So I think it could be quite a close fought affair, quite cagey. Not like PSG Bayern, not like probably quite a lot of the quarterfinals, but a little bit, two teams that are going to try and kind of suss each other out, and it might not be until the kind of final throws of the second leg where you really see them both open up.
Johnny, do you think Thomas Tuchel does need to throw caution to the wind slightly? You know, maybe it's going to be at key points. You know, he might be down a goal and need to do something a little bit different. Does that mean that he at some point needs to experiment with a different mode of playing? Because it does feel safe at times.
It does. I mean, perhaps without a striker, though, without a real, number nine that he trusts, maybe this way is his best chance of hanging in there and trying to, get the clean sheet, control the game and steal a victory. And it is actually how Chelsea won the Champions League before under Di Matteo. I mean, I think him as a coach is interesting, because until Chelsea, I don't think he's been known for defensive football. His Dortmund team scored a lot of goals. They outscored Bayern Munich on one of their seasons, and PSG obviously scored a lot of goals. And I think how he's playing with Chelsea is more a response to what he feels he's inherited in terms of the playing resources, and that when he does get a striker, we will see a change of formation and a more open style. When he talks about being brave and whatever the quote was, I'm not quite sure. I mean, I'm really not sure what he's talking about, but he is a man that sees details in the game, and perhaps he's talking about some detail of emphasis that we're not seeing. To me, it looks like Louis van Gaal football at the moment. It looks very based on positioning and covering the pitch properly and never being out of shape. But it can be, of course it can be successful in the Champions League. Often it is what wins it. And as Greg was saying, it's going to be a real chess match against Real Madrid, who've also adopted a similar style, probably because of their changing resources too.
Chelsea have reached 8 Champions League semi-finals now since the tournament became the Champions League, 92 I think it was. That's more than any other English club, Johnny. So are they now the pride of English football?
That's a startling figure that they've been in more semi-finals, but I suppose they have. I mean, they've lost a lot of semi-finals, let's face it. Are they the pride of English football? I don't know. I think I might just
There's
leave.
There's no such
one.
Thing anymore.
Hang on. That's right. But this is it.
It used to be your luck, but it's not anymore. Sorry.
Yeah. Then it was Leicester, and I don't know who it is now. I mean, Chelsea have become the establishment, I think, as I was saying earlier. And there is a lot of history for them now in the Champions League. You think, Liverpool-Chelsea semi would have had us all thinking back to the Mourinho and Benitez era. But, they are a very experienced team in this competition. And as Real Madrid are proving, and as Bayern Munich proved last year, and as Liverpool have proved before, experience in the Champions League counts for so much. And going back to City, that's another question mark, that they've just never been in a final before. So how do they manage it? Chelsea are now that team that knows their way around and has a belief, because they've done it before, that they can win it.
And have a ruthless edge, who are willing to change a manager in the middle of the season because they think that it's going to give them a better chance of progressing, particularly in the Champions League. And Mr. Abramovich has been proven right.
He has, absolutely. And Again, exactly. And an 18-month deal for Thomas Tuchel means that, you know, that pressure on him to deliver, he says the time is now. No need to think about 4 or 5 years from now. So lots of pressure on Chelsea, not just from the outside, but from within as well. And plenty more for them to look forward to this week and this season, as well as some of the other clubs in the Premier League. So much for us to look forward to in European competition as well. We will cover that all. Could be an all-English final in both the Europa League and the Champions League for that matter. Up next, let's talk a little bit about something that reflects on what we've seen in the Europa League so far this season. A huge piece of news this week involved the outcome of the racist abuse suffered by the Rangers player Glenn Kamara in the Europa League meeting with Slavia Prague last month. Slavia's Andre Kadela has received a 10-match ban for racially abusing Kamara. The Rangers midfielder has been given a 3-match ban for an assault in the tunnel afterwards. Gregor, Kadela covered his mouth when he went over and racially abused Kamara, but that meant that this was tough to prove in many ways. Lots would call it, you know, one person's word against another. Do you think the ban is too heavy, too light, fair?
It's a very difficult one to call in that way, I think. You know, it seems that the reaction of his Kamara's teammate, Bongani Zungu, his reaction in both the footage and repeating the same word, that seems to be the biggest piece of evidence, I think, that's kind of corroborating what Kamara has alleged. The full reasoning, which I think will be released in a couple of weeks, is going to be fascinating. And so is Slavia Prague's response to it all. At first, it was so defensive and almost, in fact, accusing of Kamara, to make these slights against their player and whatnot. And now it seems to be they're kind of, they're accepting it without accepting what it means. They're accepting that he's covered his mouth. He's done something that made the player feel uncomfortable. We'll learn from this. But they've never used the word racist or racism. They've never, there's been no fronting up to it at all. And if they were to appeal, it would be interesting how, again, as it's going to come down to what the full reasoning and evidence is in a couple of weeks. So it's very difficult. If you there was a lot of talk. There was a lot of really interesting writing done in the wake of this incident about if a player accuses someone of racism, why can't we just believe them? And it's really a huge part of you thinks, yeah, that's true. Why would Kamara make something like this? And you saw how upset he was. But life is not that straightforward. It's very difficult to, without evidence, to ban someone for a lot. He's going to miss the Euros, this player now. And look, I'm absolutely with Kamara. I don't have any reason to believe that anything other than this has been, he has said what he said to him, and this was an abhorrent racist slur. And if that's the case, then the ban should be lengthier. It shouldn't be 10 games, and there shouldn't be, a 7-game difference between Kamara's response to it and the incident itself. So, look, it's a very difficult one, and I think until the full reasoning is released, and I think it's going to be in a couple of weeks' time, it's hard to know if there's any further evidence. But as I say, the difference in this is always their word against mine. But the difference in this is that the footage from the incident is backed up by Zunga's reaction and him repeating the same word that was used.
Tom, this was the minimum 10 games that Kadela could have got. But there were no repercussions for the club, Slavia Prague, which is the thing that sort of raised my eyebrows the most, really. Nothing in terms of education for the players or staff. For the individual himself, Andre Kadela, there was no financial repercussion for the club. They're still in the Europa League as well. So do you think that is right, that it all rests on Kadela?
No, not at all. I think, as you said, Hugh, it is a 10-game ban minimum. And of course, also, we've got to remember that was, I think it was 2013 that Infantino brought that in, that minimum ban. And of course, I think the year before that was the case of John Terry and Luis Suarez, and who I think got 4-game bans. So we've seen progress, but when you think how far we've come in the past few years, I think 10 games still doesn't quite seem enough, really, for a organization that was saying it had zero tolerance in the mid sort of noughties. But I still think what you said, Hugh, education is the key thing, because when you have these moments in football matches, I don't think players, and even away from football matches, I don't think players think of the repercussions. I don't think they think, if I say this, I'm going to get a 10-game ban, so I won't say it. I think it is the racist underbelly that will help being eradicated by education for more than just a club. But yeah, I think there has to be wider repercussions, because it wasn't just Cadella who acted poorly in those moments. That statement was quite jaw-dropping, really, reading it when it came out the next day.
Yeah, the behaviour of Slavia Prague, not really brought into it either. And the fact that they continue in the Europa League is an odd one. They could go and win the trophy conceivably. Do you know what I mean? And I think that would be a sad thing for those watching on, to see a club that has had this happen on their way to a final eventually lift the trophy. I think the bigger punishment would have been to kick them out of the Europa League. I don't know whether that is possible, but it doesn't seem to me to be too much of a stretch. It's the same as even a massive financial penalty. You know, no financial penalty whatsoever for the club is a strange one. You know, we see players getting into a bit of a barney and clubs being fined for not controlling them. And Slavia Prague haven't got a fine for not controlling their player here, who's done something that's ended up getting him a 10-game ban. What do you think about them continuing the competition, Jonathan?
Yeah, I was listening to that, Hugh. It's interesting because I spoke to Conor Goldson the week of the incident. I interviewed him and then went back to him and discussed the incident with him. And he was captain for Rangers on the night. And he's very close to Glenn Kamara. And the thing that upset him and I think Kamara and the Rangers players the most, more than the individual reprehensible behaviour of Cadella, was actually Slavia's reaction and treatment of the incident, and UEFA themselves. And Connor said to me that you know, part of the helplessness and anger that the Rangers players felt on the night and on the pitch in the aftermath was that feeling of helplessness that the authorities aren't going to back us here, and this guy is going to be protected by his team. And he said, you know, as players were asked to get behind the UEFA slogans, we're asked to wear the T-shirts, we're asked to take the knee, and yet there's a feeling that at the heart of it, the machinery of football doesn't really support us, either the clubs or the authorities. And this is the thing that troubles me most. It's, you know, 10 games, we can debate whether it should be 10, 12, 14, 6, whatever. Justice has to be seen to be done. And I don't think it's been seen to be done here, because UEFA's initial reaction was to go for a lesser ban. This has been increased because of the effectiveness of which Rangers have made their case. But UEFA's initial reaction was a much lesser ban. We then put it in the context of the different treatments they hand out for small commercial offences, like the wrong advertising hoardings. And then you add in the 3-game ban for Kamara, which almost sort of seems to put a weird equivalence towards his behaviour, his understandable, I'm not saying any player should physically confront people, but I think a level of understanding had to be given to Kamara in the aftermath of this incident, wasn't given by the authorities. So they've almost sort of, put some kind of equivalence between the two things. And that's the thing, that this incident will just leave players feeling all the more troubled by what the authorities are really willing to do.
What Slavia did was initially was were kind of bristle at the accusation of racism, and they basically actually they kind of levelled a counter accusation of xenophobia and saying, you know, this is not what we are. You're brandishing us as racists here. But they've now changed their tone. They're saying we're willing to, you know, we're willing to cooperate with anti-racist organisations and stuff. And it, you know, that's in the space of a month. And look, you could see the first thing they're going to do is ask the player what happened, and maybe he said, "Look, I didn't do it." And then they feel compelled to try and support the player. That's, you know, that's what football clubs do. That's what managers tend to do as well. So it's not easy. None of this is easy. But the fact that in the space of a month their tone has changed so markedly, and as we're saying again, we're seeing the kind of one player has been lost for 10 games and Rangers are losing a player for 3 games. So really, you've got, as I say, for what's happened in this period, there's a difference of 7 games ban. The club otherwise has not really been punished to date anyway. I think that's wrong. The club should be punished in some way as well, because their reaction to this it's not just we didn't do this. It was a counter accusations that were levelled at Kamara and Rangers, and almost saying that they were kind of covering things up or being xenophobic themselves. So that, you know, I personally think the club should be punished as well in some way. But none of this is easy.
I know, none of it is easy. I think it was a lesson to the players, though, in a way, to take things into their own hands, not by what Glenn Kamara did in the tunnel afterwards, but if they do have those feelings that Conor Goldson mentioned of the authorities not taking things as seriously as they should or not having the appetite to deal with them, then I think they will now have that level of understanding that if there is even a small moment of incident where they feel like that, they'll walk straight off the pitch. I think we saw it recently with Diakabi, the Valencia player, who walked straight off and his teammates went with him. You know, protocol will probably change now if more players just do it at the first incident. There's not going to be any of this second and third time. And I think players around the world would have watched that incident, and now seeing that result will say, well, look, the most effective thing we can do is take away our services, take away the entertainment, take away the football, and walk straight off the pitch. But it's just a sad thing that Glenn Kamara and the Rangers players have had to go through, and very sad for football fans of all backgrounds, really, to see how seriously the authorities take it when it comes to punishing a club. And for me, I agree with you, Tom. You know, I just said there's no level of education there now. I don't know if there's any wider issue in the Czech Republic. Other clubs in Europe, we know there are wider problems in society around racism. So if this was a club in one of those countries, would they not be forcing the club to do something more around education? You know, not just for the players that are in the first team, but the youth team, the wider setup of the club, your staff, you know, for UEFA not to say this possibly could be a sign of something bigger and you need to take it far more seriously, and instead say almost the message was this was one bad apple, I think is totally the wrong thing, really. And hopefully it's a learning process for everyone involved at UEFA as well. There was a special moment this week in women's football for Northern Ireland, who reached their first major tournament. Many of their players aren't professionals. They beat Ukraine 4-1 on aggregate over the two legs. But there was, in the match, aside from Northern Ireland's goals, a hysterical moment, really. A strange moment. One of, if you haven't seen this, by the way, one of the craziest red cards you will ever see. Natalia Pantsulaya was sent off. Player running through on goal. I say running through on goal. The defender was deeper, closer to the goal. It was running through to the goalkeeper. No eyes for the ball whatsoever. She runs sideways across the pitch to body check the striker running through, when it was probably easier for her to just go and collect the ball. It was one of the oddest, strangest, craziest, if you like, red cards we have ever seen. It got us thinking about some of the wildest red cards and sending offs there ever have been. So we thought we'd rack our brains a little bit. Gregor, I'm going to start with you on this one. Firstly, have you ever seen a red card quite as bad as that? And secondly, any other reminiscent of it?
I don't think, no, I've never seen. I had to watch that several times to think, has she like pulled her hamstring? Is she doubting she's going to get to the ball here? Like, is it just kind of gone sideways to take out the opponent instead? That was bizarre. No, I've never seen that, anything like that. Although, I think I probably mentioned it before. I did once receive a second yellow card for taking a throw-in too slowly. So I was sent off essentially for a slow throw-in. The one that came to my mind was Yusuf Malumbu in 2013. Do you remember we were playing against West Ham? And it was like, I think they were losing 3-1, West Brom midfielder. And Gary O'Neill kind of tried to kind of pull him back a little bit at the end, and he just picked the ball up and volleyed it at him. Gosh, record. Do you remember? It was so bizarre. It was like, as I say, it was like an injury time. They were losing 3-1. Gary O'Neill must have done something to wind him up in the game, but he just picked up the ball and volleyed. It's a good shot as well. So that was one. Another one that came to my mind, these are slightly bizarre ones, was there was one, a Dorchester Town player manager, Ashley Vickers. There was a streaker in the Conference South once, and he was like a guy wearing a Borat kind of mankini. Yeah, and he was doing very well to evade the attentions of all the stewards for a long time. So Ashley Vickers kind of ran, he was a player, he ran up, took, tackled him to the ground, stewards took him off, the referee came up and sent him off. The ref gave him a red card for tackling a streaker. So I think they're probably the weirdest red cards I could think of.
You cannot touch someone who's entered the field of play. Those are in the rules. Dumbfounded Ashley Vickers was, by the way, by his red card afterwards. Tom, can you remember any like that?
Well, slightly similar to that with Gregor's is, and slightly more recently is Eden Hazard's with his ball boy. At Swansea City a few years ago, slightly similar in that way, but probably the most sort of cynical to me would be Cantona's when he was playing in France, and he did that diving lunge in on Michel Desakarian, and my God, the way, you know, when you've got when you were a kid and you used to set up those the slide with the soak down it and the hot water, and you go running and just launch yourself at it. The way Cantona dives into, throws his legs at Zakarian is exactly like that. And I mean, you really, if you've got to watch it again.
Jonathan?
Benjamin Massing. You've got to have a look on YouTube if you're young and you haven't seen it. But, you know, Argentina World Cup holders, opening game, Claudio Caniggia gets the ball from almost his own penalty area and just starts running on a break. And what's great about it is that first the Cameroon kind of attacker tries to make a tackle, misses him. Then one of the midfielders has a go, misses him. And then the centre back, almost like to sort of show, no, this is how it's done, boys. He comes across and he, just like a giant lawnmower, he just wipes out Caniggia. Third go, and his boot comes off in the middle of making the tackle. He sort of hits him so hard that his boot comes off. So while the referee's getting the card out, he's sort of putting on his boot and then just sort of walks off without really waiting to confirm that it's a red.
One of the best things about it is the referee goes to check on Caniggia, and while his back's turned, one of the Argentina players confronts him and he tries to kick him with the foot that the boot's not on. it's a brilliant moment. I couldn't think of many. I thought of sort of the most cynical red cards. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer against Newcastle, Rob Lee bursting through at the end of the game, just takes him out. The World Cup one, Luis Suarez, Uruguay, the handball on the line, basically saved it, you know. Steven Taylor, funniest, craziest, you know, always remember that one, pretending like he'd been shot, handballing it on the line. Brilliant, brilliant moment. If you haven't, please, if you're that young and you're listening to this podcast, you haven't seen it, definitely look up Steven Taylor's red card as well. That's a classic moment in Premier League history. And suddenly the red card comes out and he's fine, having been on the floor looking mortally wounded as well. I'd love it.
What was the one as well quite recently, the Atletico Real Madrid one, when the guy was clean through and he just chased back and booted him in the calf? It was in a cup. Was it not in a cup final or a cup semi-final?
Oh, do you know what? Yeah, I do remember this. In the final, who was it? Valverde. Oh, God, I'm just watching it. It's so bad. It's the same as Solskjaer, very similar to Solskjaer's. He just boots him. And I think in classic Real Madrid against Atletico Madrid style, 5 minutes later, Real Madrid won it on penalties as well. So
it always
works out that way. Yeah, absolutely. Gentlemen, pleasure being with you for the past hour or so. Tom Roddy, Jonathan Northcroft and Gregor Robertson, thank you so much. And thank you for listening as well. Remember, for more of our award-winning journalism, get yourself a digital subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times. You'll get more of our award-winning journalism on all of your devices. If you sign up today, you'll get 1 month free. Go online, search thetimes.co.uk/thegame to get started. We've got the FA Cup semi-finals coming up this weekend. We'll discuss that and more on Monday. We'll see you then.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.